Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Intercooler Podcast with me, Dan Prosser, Andrew Frankel, my co-host. This is episode 210, magazine style. Lots of things we want to talk about, lots of news.
So much. I hope we get through it.
I know, there's an awful lot of ground that we're going to try and cover. We just had a break and we checked our phones and we saw, we're recording this on the Wednesday, and we saw that it's been confirmed that Adrian Newey is leaving Red Bull.
Yeah. Now, you listening to this on a Monday, you may know where he's going. We don't.
And I mean, we heard that... The reports were out there a couple of weeks ago, weren't they? So this is not really a surprise, but it has now been confirmed. What do you make of it all? I mean, do you understand why he's leaving? And if you're a 65-year-old multi-millionaire, are you looking for another job? Or we all know he's just taken delivery of his new yacht. Maybe you sail that off into the sunset.
I don't see Adrian's 65 now. That's the age, certainly in the past, that people used to retire at. I don't see it at all. Somebody once described him as the most competitive person who'd ever been born. Okay, if he felt that somehow his powers are waning or something, which I don't believe for a moment, then maybe he'd quit. But no, I think his, he's been off to do other things in the past, hasn't he? And, you know, so he's going to spend the rest of his time at Red Bull finishing the RB17 hypercar. And, you know, he's talked about doing an America's Cup boat and that sort of. But actually, he's just stayed in Formula One. I think he'll stay in Formula One and he'll go wherever he wants. Everybody is saying it's Ferrari. What will be very interesting is how that works out. Because is he going to go and live in Maranello? Which is essentially what he would have to do. I don't know Adrian very well. I know him a little bit, but I speak to I'd be surprised. I would be surprised if at 65, with everything, he doesn't have to do a damn thing he doesn't want to do. But if he said, fine, but I want to do it from the UK, you are, so I think that's going to sound frightfully patronising, but you're probably too young to remember John Barnard.
Well, no, I do remember, and there's a precedent here, isn't
there? Yeah, GTO Engineering, was it? No, GTO Technical, whatever it was. But basically, Ferrari's technical input into its Formula One cars, the cars were still built in Italy, but they were designed in Surrey. So it has happened before. So I don't know how it's going to work if he goes to Ferrari. So he is clearly now leaving because press release has gone out. But I do just want to mention 2001 when he was going to go to Jaguar. You know, he was announced. The press release went out with quotes from Adrian saying now is the time to take up the exciting challenge of Jaguar racing. and he still didn't go. So, yeah, I mean, he is going to go this time. But I guess Ferrari, but watch this space.
We understand the draw of Ferrari, don't we? I mean, all the drivers want to drive for Ferrari. It's the most romantic team. It's the most successful team. It's the most famous team.
Yeah.
But there is a particular draw here because Newey could be... He could go there and be the guy who returned championship-winning glory to Maranello.
After the longest drought
in
its history.
I mean...
That's got to be an appeal.
It would... As if his career hasn't been extraordinary enough, that would just cap it off in some fashion, wouldn't it?
I mean, he is the most successful... I mean, if you had a choice of Adrian Newey coming to your team or any driver in the history of Formula One, you'd take Adrian, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you would. You would.
because a decent driver can win a championship in an Adrian car. The best driver in the world can't win a championship in a so-so car.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
So he's you know, he's the most important component, I think, and I think he's been this way for a very long time, in any team, frankly. He's the most important person in Formula One from a competition point of view, which is an extraordinary thing to say. And I don't know whether his power is now that as being a sort of talismanic inspirer of people, or how much it is still him looking at the rule book and thinking, oh, we can do this, we can do that, just spotting stuff that other people don't spot. Or maybe his job is other people do all the spotting and they then come to him and go, what do you think? And he's the bloke who goes, no, yes, that one. And he just knows what's going to work.
Just when Formula One is a bit staid and predictable, and we know week in, week out, probably who's going to win the race.
Yeah.
I'm so glad we've got these big announcements. Lewis to Ferrari for the start of next season. Newey leaving Red Bull. It needs these things, these movements, to keep it interesting, to shake things up.
But just how, you know... pissed off do we think that Adrian must have become to have given up? I mean, he's been at Red Bull since 2006.
In the midst of their most dominant period.
Yeah.
To then go, I'm off.
Yeah.
It's amazing, isn't it? It says a lot.
Yeah, but I guess he feels... I mean, the thing is, if he didn't go this year, he'd have to go at the end of next year. It's too late.
For the new rule set in 26. Yeah.
It's too late. So the 2026 car would have been done by somebody else, and that'll set... So if he's going to go... He's got to go now because otherwise, you know, the opportunity's gone. And, you know, and I think that's probably the thinking behind it. And maybe he's thinking to himself, well, you know, Red Bull, fine, but they won't have a Honda powertrain anymore. It is ambitious, to say the least, to think that the Red Bull powertrain is just going to come in and be the class of the field. Particularly when there's a Honda in the back of the Aston Martin, and maybe Ferrari have got their own thoughts about that sort of thing. And maybe he's doing a Lewis. Maybe he is thinking, this is my chance to, if anybody ever doubted that in my field I was the greatest person that there ever was, I have this God-given opportunity to go and do it. And the opportunity is the 2026 rules. And I think it's what's sent Lewis to Ferrari. And if he goes, it'll be what sends Adrian to Ferrari.
Yeah. Yep. Well, let's hope there isn't any more movement on this news story over the weekend, because we're going to be horribly out of date by the time this goes out on Monday.
Yes.
And on the same token, let's hope the Miami Grand Prix is an unremarkable one.
Yes.
Actually, no, I'm really hoping for an exciting weekend. But we're recording this on the 1st of May.
Yeah.
2024.
Yeah.
Which means it's 30 years to the day since that terrible accident at Tamburello, Imola.
Yeah.
That took Ayrton Senna's life.
Yeah.
So I think we do need to pause and reflect.
On the whole weekend.
Well, that's right, the whole weekend. And actually it starts not even with Roland Ratzenberger, but with Rubens Barrichello.
Yeah.
I was 7 years old, not watching Formula One at that time.
Yeah.
Wasn't aware at all, actually, of all this going on. You'll have been watching.
Well, the Barrichello one I wasn't. I was at work, because I think it was on the Friday, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
And we got a call. I guess it would have been from Alan Henry, our Formula One correspondent, to say that this had happened and that we would prepare ourselves for the worst.
Oh, my God. Oh gosh.
It was, yeah. You know, there was a if you see it, I mean, you can't imagine how.
Does it hit the tires, go up into catch fencing? Is it that one?
It's the one, basically. Well, yes, it does, but it's the stop. It's such an enormous stop. Mm. And yeah, it's just one of those gut-wrenching accidents which just looks unsurvivable. But actually, he was okay. He didn't race, but I think he was back at the track the next day. Absolutely extraordinary. Mm. Thank goodness for that. But obviously, far, far worse was to come.
So what day was Roland? It was on the Saturday, wasn't it? Roland Ratzenberger.
Roland back was on the Saturday, yeah. And, you know, he was apparently he was a lovely guy, Austrian. It was his third Formula One race.
Yeah.
You know, he'd had a sort of so-so career coming up through the ranks. He'd been in British Formula Ford and British Formula 3. He'd done some sports car. He'd done quite a lot of F3000. I don't think, if I'm honest, and I think it's important at times like this to be honest, that we don't sort of, you know, rewrite history and say, oh, you know, he was a future world champion in waiting. I don't think he was, which is, you know, is neither here nor there. Here's someone who'd found his way into Formula One, was trying to make his, and, you know, had this appalling accident, the most terrible, so for anybody who doesn't know, he damaged his car. I think he spun it. On a previous lap and maybe ran over a curb or something. And, you know, unbeknownst to him, his front wing was loose. And, yeah, at 190-something miles an hour, the wing came off, got lodged under the front of the car, and then he was a passenger, and that was that. Absolutely dreadful. First person to die on a Formula One weekend for a dozen years. Mm. And I can remember thinking... And this was all, you know, about the time when there was lots of stuff going on in Formula One, with, you know, lots of electronics in Formula One cars, lots of suggestion that some teams weren't playing by the rules and that sort of thing. And, you know, and thinking that despite all the shenanigans and all the things that are wrong with Formula One, what was great about Formula One is people weren't getting killed anymore. Mm. And as, you know, someone who was born in the 60s and grew up in the 70s, you know, as a kid growing up in it, you know, it was fairly frequent. It was a fairly common event that people would die doing that. And that seemed to have stopped. And then suddenly, two in a weekend, one of them being the most famous and greatest driver of his era, was absolutely... I mean, it was such a shock, I suppose. Yeah, such a bolt from the blue.
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
Gosh. So what were your... memories? What were you doing on that day? How did you find out?
On the Sunday, I was up in Mid Wales in the Yealand Valley, mucking about some old cars with my family. So I was with my brothers and my father, and I think we must have gone out and driven some old cars in the morning because the race would have been on, I guess, at about 2 o'clock. So I think we would have had lunch. And we were just watching the race. There was a big room downstairs in the Lake Vernouy Hotel, I think we were in. And the Formula One was on, and everybody who was part of it, we were on some, can't remember what it was, some car club junket. And we were all just sort of watching it and, you know, watched it happen in front of us. Mm. And, you know, when it happened, I thought to myself, oh, I thought that's horrible. That's really, really horrible. But it never occurred to me at the time that his life, it didn't look like the sort of accident that would kill a man. Mm. You know, we'd seen, you know, because don't forget, it happened, what, 13, 14 years after the first carbon fiber tub had come into Formula One. And we were then used to seeing some big, big crashes and drivers just unbelt themselves and hop out. Mm. And we'd seen... obviously, Gerhard Berger have that terrible accident at the same corner in, I think it was 89, where he was just sat in the car after this big accident and suddenly, woof, the whole thing goes up in flames. And he was, you know, he was quite badly burned, but I can't remember how many races he missed, but he was back during the course of that season. And I don't think had any sort of long-lasting effects. And so I saw it and just thought, that's a really horrible accident. I hope he's okay. Hope it doesn't, you know... because he'd had such a bad start to the season. Mm. He hadn't scored a point. But he was on pole, you know, and he was, you know, he was clearly, you know, Schumacher was clearly the man, the coming man. There was some suggestion that the Benetton that he was driving wasn't entirely playing by the rules. I don't know whether that was true or not. But Senna was a man on a mission. You know, he had to get his campaign, you know, his first season at Williams, you know, underway. And yeah, it happened. And I guess the longer it went on, the longer he was sat there in the car and not moving. And then, you know, there was all the medical intervention and the screens went up and the hell. And you're thinking, this clearly isn't good. Anyway.
It's tragic. It's funny, isn't it, when you watch the Senna film and you know precisely what's coming, but there's a bit of you that hopes it's different this time.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't. It's not a hard thing to talk about in terms of emotionally, because it's 30 years. But when you think back to it, and you don't sort of just sort of glance at it and fleetingly remember, when you actually think back to where you were, what you were doing, how you felt, it still feels shocking. It really does still feel utterly shocking. And particularly in the context of everything that had already gone on that weekend. And, you know, and I do remember very much just how revered a man he was, not just in his native Brazil, where he was as close a thing to a demigod as you can get. But, you know, in the autocar office, we were all Senna fans. No Prost fans in the office. Or if they did, they kept very quiet. And we weren't sort of fans of really anybody else out there. There were some Damon fans out there, and rightly so. But in terms of people, you know, we wanted Damon to win because he was Damon and he was a good bloke and he was his father's son and it was a great story and we liked the bloke. But Senna, we idolised, in so much as a bunch of fairly hard-bitten hacks could idolise a driver. And, you know, I was 2 when Jim Clark died. So, you know, no memory of that. But it was our Jim Clark moment. It was as shocking, I'm sure, as Jim Clark's death. Probably more so, because back in Jim Clark's day, people did die in Formula One cars. I've never felt a moment like it watching a motor race, and I hope I never do.
Do you think he was still at the peak of his powers at that time? Or had something started to slip?
I don't think there's any evidence for that. I don't think we really know. But you think back to, you know, Donington the previous year. He wasn't exactly shabby then, was he?
No.
And he was, I can't remember how old, but was he 34, something like that?
I think he was. And he, the interesting thing for me was that he was in, so 94 we're talking about, he's in a Williams. So Schumacher in the Benetton, 94-95. But then 96-97, they were Williams championship winning years, weren't they?
Yes.
So I think Senna had an awful lot of success ahead of him.
I agree. I think he could have easily had another 3, 4, 5 seasons in him at the top. There is no reason, I think, to think that he was going off the boil. His age doesn't suggest that he was going off the boil. His age, he would have probably been in his prime. It's terrible.
It really is. To mark the occasion, the 30th anniversary of his passing, we published a story on our app and website about driving his personal Honda NSX.
Yeah.
Ben Oliver found the car and went and drove it, which is a very, very special thing to get to do. So the story is live.
When he suggested this, when he said, oh, I can go and drive Senna's NSX, I'm so cynical.
Yeah, that's right. Did he drive it from
because I can remember a competition we did in autocar with a Renault 1916 valve, which was billed as Nigel Mansell's Renault 1916 valve. I'm not sure how long he owned it for, but it was probably about 10 minutes. I might be doing Nigel and Renault a huge disservice here, but it was just one of those things that, you know, was done to say that this was his car. And it was his car. This was a car in which Senna had driven thousands and thousands of miles.
Yeah.
This was his NSX.
He really used it at his home in Portugal.
Yeah.
There are photos of him with it. And the car's in the UK now. It's actually up for sale. £500,000 the owner wants for it, which seems a lot.
That's interesting, isn't it? How do you value a car like that? What is the price for that? I mean, okay, if it wasn't Senna's car, it'd be worth, I don't know, what a... decent NSXs worth
these
days.
Well, they're definitely up, so maybe close to 100 or something.
Yeah, say call it 100.
Mm.
So it's interesting. If you are a Senna obsessive, and you're a wealthy Senna obsessive, you know, there are people who get this about certain drivers.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
There is a bloke in historic racing circles who is a Mike Hawthorne. I don't think obsessive is too wrong a word. And basically anything that's ever had anything to do with Mike Hawthorne's life, he has collected. And he can afford to do so. There must be people out there who feel the same way about Senna. And if they think to themselves, here is a chance to have a proper, real, genuine, legitimate Honda NSX that was the car that Ayrton chose to drive, probably still has his DNA all over it. I can see someone right. If the money is not important to
them. Yeah, I can see it.
I can see it. And if there isn't, then, you know, the money's either too cheap. In a way, it's either not nearly enough or it's much too much.
What's interesting is that the it's just listed on Auto Trader. It's not on one of the auction sites. It's not on, you know, with one of the big auction houses.
Yeah,
It's on Auto Trader. It's curious, isn't it? So let's move it on and talk just very briefly about our display at Bicester Heritage for the Sunday Scramble recently. Yeah. We had, well, a Senna, actually, a McLaren Senna, alongside a McLaren Speedtail.
Yeah.
And a McLaren P1,
and
a McLaren Elva.
Yeah.
So that's the four Ultimate Series cars. And in the middle of the four of them, a McLaren F1.
Yeah, the granddaddy of them all.
Indeed.
Mm.
First time those five cars have been seen in public together.
Yeah, I mean, we had to do a bit of research into this because I can when we decided that this is what we wanted to do, and obviously it involves some conversations with McLaren because you know, they helped us with cars from the Ultimate Collection. And I said to them, when were these cars last seen together in public? And they went, I'm not sure that they ever have. And they went away and they did some digging, and we went away and did some digging. And we have now said so many times, no one's contradicted it. No one has said, oh, yes, but you know, the Tokyo Motor Show and such. They've never been seen before. And we can't spend too long on this because, you know, if you weren't there and you didn't see them, you know, this probably won't be too big a deal for you. But for us, it was a really big deal to do something which hadn't been done before at a place like Bicester Heritage, which, you know, is the very few places which we enjoy going to more, particularly at Sunday Scramble time. And, yeah, we're proud to have done it, to have gotten there.
Very proud.
And enormous thanks to the bloke who provided the F1.
Hopefully he's listening, but he provided the F1 and another car, a Bugatti
110.
Thank you for doing that.
One of 10.
He did turn up, hung around for a while, was in great spirits.
Yeah.
So thank you to him. Also McLaren for providing the other cars.
Yeah.
To Bicester Heritage for giving us the space.
Yes.
But mostly to everybody who came up and took photos and said hello and interacted with us and said kind things. It was great to meet so many of you, as it always is at the Sunday Scramble. We'll be at the next one.
What are we going to do?
We've got to go big. We've got to go big.
Yeah.
We need to give that some thought.
Maybe get in touch with us on social media. You'll find, you know, if you just look for the Intercooler or on Twitter or Instagram, what would you like to see us do? We've probably got space for five cars, maybe six. We definitely have lots of ideas. In fact, we probably have too many ideas. But I don't know. Should we just try and find, you know, cars which are worth even more money than that? That would be difficult.
Yeah.
Should we go for another single mark theme, or should we go for another theme like, you know, the fastest cars or the rarest cars or the lightest cars, or, you know, any thoughts you have, find a way of getting them to us and they will all go into the pot.
Yeah, we want to know.
Yeah.
I want to talk about some cars that have been sold recently or will be offered for sale soon on Pistonhead's auction platform.
Yeah.
One of them I wrote about ahead of time. I spotted it. This 2008 Audi R8, so a V8 manual.
Yeah.
Gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous.
How much?
29.3.
When are those cars going to move?
Honestly, at some point they're going to go up. I'm sure. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they're just going to keep slipping. I don't know.
I can remember doing a job with one of these things. It must have been about 10 years ago. I took a modern R8 and went and drove one of these things. And it was a lovely example. It was about 35 grand. I think to myself, oh God, you know, if I had the money and if I had, you know, if it's fitted my life, I'd love, because I know the time's going to come when I'm going to look back at these things and there'll be 80 grand. I won't be able to look at it. But they still haven't moved.
No.
Why is that, do you think? Do you think it's just the wrong badge? Do you think an Audi just isn't glamorous enough?
Are they too common? Are there actually quite a few of them out there?
I don't know how many manual early cars there are knocking about. Maybe quite a few. I don't know.
But are we expecting a 911, so a 997 Carrera of the same age, to rise in value soon? Do we have that same expectation?
Well, no, but I think there'll be many more 997s of that age. So they really will be supply limited in the wrong way, in that insofar as the supply is too high rather than too low. So I think that will always keep their prices down to an extent. Yeah, it's weird. It's really strange.
I keep saying, and I wrote a blog piece for us, saying that every year I predict that these cars are going to rise in value, and it hasn't happened. So
yeah.
I'm just beginning to wonder if it's never going to happen. But actually, we know the chap who bought this one. He is a friend of ours. Maybe that means we'll get to have a go in it. But I adore these cars, and like you, I keep thinking I'll have one someday. And I just need to make sure I get in there before they do start rising in value. So another one that I spotted, and goodness me, these cars look like fantastic value at the moment. 2000 Aston Martin DB7 Vantage V12.
Yeah.
72,000 miles. This one needed a bit of work, so it wasn't an immaculate car. So it's you know, not exactly top of the market, this one. 11 grand.
A V12 Aston Martin for £11,000. Oh, blimey. Which means you could probably get it for a tenner, couldn't you? What to say about that? You'd still need to be a bit brave, wouldn't you?
I think, well, you would. You would.
Unless you took... You see, what is the price level? I guess it differs for everyone, at which a car becomes disposable. Mm. What is the price level? If you spent, you know, £2,000 on a Boxster, like our mate Johnny Smith has done, and then suddenly you realise the car is completely ruined. It's riddled with this, that, and the other, and there are warning lights. You know, your dash looks like a Christmas tree. At the end of the day, you can just throw the car away because it'll be painful, but it's not going to, you know, for most people, it's not going to change the quality of your life. You can't do that if you're spending a five-figure sum on a car.
I don't think so. Not the typical person, no.
No.
So that's why it is a punt.
So
isn't
if
it?
You get a big bill, you're going to kind of have to pay it, aren't you? Yeah. That's the thing.
Yeah. But the thing is, if you have the money to be able to do that, and that's why these cars are such value by the looks of it, if you have the money to sink 11 grand into one of these and wear the bills as they come, you've got the money to buy a more modern car or an older classic car or something
or,
else.
Or the same car, but without any problems and half the miles on the clock.
Yeah. Which is why these things look such value.
Yeah.
But goodness me, if it works, that is a heck of a car.
I mean, I can remember back in the day.
I will just point out, that's what I paid for my Up.
Yeah, well, there you go. A three-cylinder Volkswagen hatchback or a V12 Aston Martin. Choice is yours. But it's back. I was just saying, you know, back in the day, you know, we always used to sort of marvel at the fact you could buy a V12 Ferrari for 10 grand. Because, you know, an old 400i, an automatic old 400i. But we actually always told people, don't do it, because the car will find a way of ruining you. I think it's an interesting idea, and for the right sort of brave purpose, because I mean, there will be times when people do that and they're really glad because the car does turn out to be okay and they take a realistic view over maintenance and whoop-de-doop. But I'm not that brave, I'm afraid.
Okay, one more. 2008 Ferrari F430 Coupe. Paddle shift car, most of them weren't they?
Yeah.
35,000 miles. This is live on the platform at the moment.
Yeah.
Guiding at 66 to 68. What are those cars like, the F430?
Do you know, I think that they are slightly under the radar type Ferraris, because I don't think they're anything like as... Well, I know they're not anything like as revered as 458s. And I think they live slightly in the shadow. The 458 was such a big step on from that, in looks, in power, and in everything, really. I always quite like them. I don't think they're up there in the pantheon of great mid-engine Ferraris. but they're a hell of a lot better than things like a 360,
yeah,
or a 348. I would say they're probably not quite as revered as a 355, but underrated cars, nice cars. I think they're. I saw one at Bicester actually, just sort of grumbling about. And I actually thought, and I never thought this when they're new, I actually thought it looked pretty good.
Frank Stephenson design, isn't it?
Yeah.
They do look good.
Yeah.
How's that paddle shift gearbox? Because we have spoken about that sort of transmission before, haven't we? The robotized manual.
Yeah. I mean it depends what you're using it for. I mean, you wouldn't want to drive through central London with it.
Oh.
I mean, it'd be all right. But if you leave it in its automatic mode, it's really pretty clunky. And when you're out and about in it, you just have to learn it. It's like driving, I don't know, an old 1930s gearbox without synchromesh. You know, you can do it, and it can go very well and very smoothly as long as you do it the way the gearbox wants to do it. You can't just do what you want to do. So you have to time it and wait. But if you do that, it's fine. The shifts will be very slow by modern standards, but still quite quick in terms of, by the comparison of how fast you can move your hand. But you will spend your time driving the car thinking, if only it were a manual. But then I guess if it were a manual, it would be, what, 20 grand more? I don't know.
Oh, yeah, probably.
Yeah.
So there you go. Now, if you're looking to buy or you're just browsing, visit pistonheads.com/TI, or you can click the link in the description to see what's live on the platform right now and what sold recently. If you're thinking of selling your car on Pistonheads auction platform, use the same link, pistonheads.com/TI, and remember to choose the option that says the intercooler sent you. Thank you for doing that. We've still got lots of ground that we need to cover.
Yeah. What's next?
Let's do Aston Martin Vanquish.
Can't call it that. Oh, secret.
I think we probably can. So they announced in the last few days that the V12... there is a new V12. New. I mean, we think it's a development of the old 5.2.
We don't think it's a new development of the old. We know it's a development of the old 5.2.
Fine. But the V12 lives on. And there were some people, I remember seeing a few people on social media telling anyone that that's it, it was dead. The V12 no longer is a thing at Aston Martin. They were wrong. The first car it's going to appear in is the new front engine flagship.
The DBS that's, replacement.
That's right. And
the car we absolutely can't call Vanquish.
Well, the very last line of the press release announcing the V12 went all, what was it? All rivals or something will be.
All will be vanquished.
Will be vanquished. Yes. So. There we go. That's confirmation as good as that car is going to be called Vanquish. Which I think that's the right name. I think that is the right name.
I still don't like it.
Oh, I think it's fantastic.
I've never liked the Vanquish name.
Really?
When I first heard it in 2000, 2001. I mean, I say, well, I'm used to it. I don't know.
Do you remember the Bond version they renamed?
The Vanish.
The Vanish.
Maybe that's why it still annoys me. The worst Bond movie that there's ever been. Yeah. I don't know. I just... Vanquish. I just don't think it's very...
I like it.
I just don't think it's a very nice word.
Oh, okay.
I think it's a perfectly good name for an Aston Martin. I just don't think as a word... it's just... I mean... It's not... Okay. If you were writing a story about one car beating another, would you say it vanquished? It's just...
It's a bit try-hard, isn't it?
It's a bit try-hard. I also think it's quite sort of old.
Okay.
Anyway.
But do you have any intel on the car itself?
Well, I do, but I'm not sure what I can say. I need another press release in front of me. Because I'm in, you know, there are NDAs and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But we know there's on the car rather than the engine. I've seen it.
Yeah.
I can't tell you what it looks like.
Are you allowed to say if you liked it?
Don't think so.
Okay, right.
Okay. If I was allowed to say that I liked it, I would say that I did, but I'm not, so I can't.
You're so naughty. Okay. I think we should leave Aston Martin there before we get ourselves in trouble.
Oh, hang on. Can we just talk a bit about it? So it's 800. We just need to say a bit about it.
835, I think, horsepower.
Yeah.
A whole wedge of torque.
Yeah. Can we also, that engine.
Yeah.
Okay. Which... You know, that engine first appeared in a Ford concept car. I think it was called the Indigo in about 1995. I think it had 420 horsepower. And then it made its first appearance in the DB7 Vantage when it had 420 horsepower. So its output has basically doubled, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Now, it's gained a couple of turbochargers, which I'm sure of help. But, I mean, that is such a long-serving motor, isn't it? And it's interesting, isn't it, that they haven't just gone to Mercedes-Benz and said, oh, just do us, you know, the ultimate high-powered V8. Or, I mean, Mercedes-Benz have a V12, but it's not very appropriate for that sort of use. So, yeah, I mean, but I think it does just say what we kind of know is that when you're in that kind of, in that league, you can just say, well, okay, I know that it's heavier and I know that it's expensive and the emissions are probably rubbish and I'm going to get taxed out of existence and that stuff. But you know what? I just like a V12.
Yeah.
So I'll have a V12 if that's all the same to you.
There are people out there, and it will only be built in limited numbers. I assume this is a sort of emissions legislation thing. They can only get so many out the door before they get hit with those EU fines.
I don't know. I don't know what the exemptions are for a company like Aston Martin.
No, it's complicated, isn't it? But either way, they're not going to do many of them.
Yeah.
And I can well imagine there are enough people out there who just want the 12.
Yeah.
And why not?
So the question is, what else are they going to use it for?
Well, they've left the door open for it to go in other things. So maybe there'll be, I don't know, have they said that there'll never be a 12-cylinder version of the DB12?
I don't think they said never. They said there isn't one. I think never's a very long time. I suspect there will be, you know, some limited editions. Do you remember the Speedster and that sort of thing, which they did off, you know, which was sort of, you know, half DB11, half Vantage in terms of its sort of front and rear end architectures. So, yeah, watch this space.
There will be bits and pieces, won't there?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Let's mix it up then. We're going from V12 to EV.
Oh, yeah.
I know you've got a few things you want to say. Get off your chest.
Well, no, it's not a question of getting off my chest. I mean, I think that out there, people think that we are quite EV skeptic. Maybe even anti-EV. And I'm not. I really am not. I think that EVs have massive potential. They are unquestionably cleaner. Even however you look at it, and you can argue over just how much cleaner they are, but they are cleaner than ICE cars. I think that in one form or another, whether it's developed by a battery or a fuel cell, electric cars are the future. And, you know, I look forward to them being widely chosen and available and suiting the circumstances of the vast majority of people, because at the moment they just don't. And the reason I wanted to talk about it is at all ends of the market, you are seeing manufacturers just going, oh, hold on a moment, and putting the brakes on. So, yeah, well, where should we start? So Aston Martin, they were going to show us their first EV next year. That's been pushed back to 2027, and I rather get the impression that's at the earliest. Bentley was going to be an all-EV brand by 2030. It's not anymore.
Oh, is that right?
No.
Wow.
It's now it is now an aspiration. It is still an intention, but there's no date anymore. Mm. It's sort of early 2030s. So they are clearly and understandably giving themselves some wriggle room. Slightly in the sort of more premium area, you know, we know, for instance, that Mercedes-Benz is completely reevaluating its electrification strategy. We know that Ford is doing the same, you know, having killed the Fiesta and shortly to kill the Focus. Mm. It now, and you know, we did talk about this, we've written about this, and we have said this. I think they're now beginning to realize that they are massively exposed. Without having any representation at that part of the market. So I think that they are going to, you know, I don't know what they're going to do, but it's, and even things like, you know, I was reading the other day that the electric Fiat Panda's been postponed and kicked into the long grass. And I think what is happening, and I guess the important point is that the problem basically stems from government mandating things, saying you have to do this by this date, forcing stuff upon manufacturers who then have to completely change the entire way that they do their business without any proven knowledge about what the customer demand and without the infrastructure being in place. And what you do then is you try to force this stuff upon an unwilling public or a skeptical public or a concerned public and a public who actually is really pretty happy knocking about in their Fiestas and their Focuses. And so the public, and we see this always, there will always be early adopters and people, and they all pile in, and they've done that now. But we know from the falling retail sales of EVs, and we know that, you know, the two biggest EV manufacturers in the world, for Tesla and BYD, their sales are falling at the moment. And why is this? It's because of all the things that we've talked about so many times. It's about the infrastructure. It's about the withdrawal of government grants. It's about, you know, it's about range. It's about charging times. It's about all these things that make, at the moment, an EV a suboptimal purchase compared to a normal car for so many people. And as we've also discussed, you know, if you do short journeys and you have off-street parking and you have another car, an EV is a near perfect solution. But that's not everybody. It's not even most people. It's not remotely most people. Yeah. And I think that is what we are seeing. And this is before, let us not forget, you know, the government has even begun to think about how it's going to recover all the billions in lost tax revenue from fuel duty.
Indeed.
So was that a bit of a rant?
No, I thought it was
I don't want to be misunderstood.
Yeah.
I would love an EV either for short distances and for running about and as an urban vehicle, personal transport in town. I think that's absolutely fantastic. I would be very happy for an EV if I could charge it in next to no time, and if it would do 400 miles on a charge, to have that as my daily driver. Mm. You know, as transport, I still struggle with the idea of sporting electric cars.
Yeah,
electric cars being fun to drive. But no, so the theory I am completely at home to.
Mm. Now, listen, I'm really glad that you wanted to talk about this week, because I wanted to as well.
Ooh.
I've spent a really good amount of time in a couple of very different EVs recently.
Yeah.
And that has helped crystallize my thoughts on what is a very important topic, as actually did our podcast with James May.
Yeah.
Episode 200. We spoke at some length about EVs and had, I think, a balanced, nuanced, informed discussion about EVs.
From someone who is very definitely seen to be in the pro EV lobby, if that's not too pejorative a sense.
That's right. and so I really understand now where I stand on these cars. So I was in a very powerful EV, a Porsche Taycan Turbo S Sport Turismo.
Do anything interesting in it?
I did, actually. Yes, so I took it to Shelsley Walsh, the hill climb in Worcestershire. And I went there to try and break a couple of records.
Yeah.
And I did, actually. The story is on the Intercool app and website right now. The video is on our YouTube channel. It's a nice little film. It's not exactly YouTube gold that, because no one's looking for electric car hill climb records, I don't think. So it's not going to do mega views, but it's a nice little film, I think.
Go take a look.
So yeah, please do go take a look. So I was in that one for a while. I was in a Citroen EC4X for a while, which is a nice enough car, actually. £35,000, I think it starts at. Comfortable. It is really just a car. But I used them both quite substantially, and I had to public charge them. Now, I need to get this. I need to say this first. I can't charge at home.
Yeah.
Right. I've got parking at home, but I don't have a wall unit, so I can't charge at home. If I had an EV, clearly I'd get a unit installed. I would be able to. So, but nevertheless, there are plenty of people who can't charge an EV at home.
Yeah.
So it's not an unrepresentative experience. But I realized that I think half of my public charging experiences that I've ever had, I think half have been good. You turn up, it's available, it's working, you plug it in, it accepts your card with a tap, you plug it in, it starts charging, you walk away. That's a good experience.
Yeah.
That's how it should be.
Yeah.
Half the time it's like that. It's just not good enough. If half the time you turned up to a petrol station and you couldn't get fuel, what would you think?
And if every time you've suddenly thought about refueling or recharging your car, you thought to yourself, well, actually, I need to do it sooner even than that, because if I go as far as I know this car can go and what it's already got, but then discover I can't charge it, I'm completely stuffed.
Mm, mm. I've just had too many where you turn up and it's not charging. My nearest motorway service station just off the M5 has a load of Tesla chargers. Yeah. Great. It's got two chargers for everyone else.
Yeah.
One of them wasn't working. And judging by the
so
two...
I know the services you mean.
Yeah.
There are two chargers for everybody else.
I think there's two units. So I think there's two in each one. So yeah, I think four people can charge.
Yeah.
But one of them was broken, so two could charge. Except judging by the two guys standing and poking at the screen for 10 minutes, it wasn't working. But too often I turn up, plug the car in, and it doesn't start charging, or it doesn't accept my bank card. So I have to use a personal bank card, which is a pain when you're traveling for work.
Yeah.
Or it's out of action, or it charges very slowly, or whatever.
Or there's some app you have to download.
Yeah, exactly. It's just not good enough. Nevertheless, I've definitely my thoughts on EVs have crystallized, and I'm like you. I think for normal driving, the electric motor is far superior to the combustion engine. When all you want to do is get somewhere, I think it's perfect because they're compact.
Yeah,
you get a load of torque out of them and decent power. They are smooth. They are very, very quiet.
Yeah,
they require very little maintenance.
Yeah.
They don't spit terrible things out the back. So electric motor, fantastic. Yeah. If you want to drive for fun, for pleasure, for excitement, I think you probably do need a combustion engine, a transmission. But for the vast majority of people, the vast majority of time, electric motor is superior. My issue is with the lithium ion battery.
Oh, go on.
Because they are enormously heavy.
Oh, yeah.
They are very expensive, and they make EVs heavy and expensive. They're not that energy dense because you can't go that far on a full charge, particularly if you drive in a slightly spirited way. You cannot go that far, really. They don't charge that quickly. So there is an inherent limitation in terms of usability and flexibility there. So I think it's overly simplistic to talk about EVs. I think we need to talk about different types of EV, and the EV as it is today, electric motor, fantastic. They are massively undermined for me, and I can only talk about my personal experience. If yours is different, great. For me, EVs are massively undermined by the limitations of the battery technology as it is.
Yeah, I think we've known that since they're much better than the old nickel metal hydride batteries.
Yeah.
And before that, the lead acid batteries. But yes, I mean, we've said this for years, haven't we? You know, we are waiting for the big breakthrough. And there are within the whole area of lithium-ion batteries, there are different chemistries, different technologies, and they are getting better. But yes, no, you're absolutely right. They're still not where most people need them to be.
Mm.
But, you know, the last thing I think I want to say to this is, just because it's not my personal experience, but it's quite a related experience, my brother, he has a commute of 20, 30 miles a day, maybe each way, maybe 40, so maybe he does 40 or 50 miles a day. He has off-street parking, and he can charge, and he's a complete petrol head, probably more than me. And he goes to work in an MG4, because why wouldn't you?
Yeah. Well, ideally, isn't it?
It costs nothing to charge. Mm. It's completely quiet and silent and comfortable, and, you know, and as a form of transport, it works terribly well for a certain lucky small sector of the community.
Mm.
But they're not for everyone yet.
No.
Enough, I feel.
Well, we need to finish in a moment, but there is a new version of the Alpine A110 that you wanted to discuss briefly, wasn't there?
It's not an EV, though.
No, I know. Of course not.
And when I said enough, I meant that's enough EV talk. I don't mean that's enough talk, end of podcast.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I know. But you want to... So has it been... It's not been announced.
Well, I don't want to talk about this. I want you to talk about it. Because you are... You know, our homegrown,
well, apparently,
Alpine owning expert. So I have been reading, and I believe it is true that the much beloved A110, our only ever 10-star car, is shortly to go out of production. It's been around for about 7 years now.
So it's about time, isn't it?
It's not being replaced by a like-for-like model. And so it was a sort of run-out special. They are doing this ultralight sub-1-ton version, which will have quite a lot more power.
330 or
something? Yeah, 330 horsepower. So that's like almost 100 horsepower more than the standard car, and maybe like 50 horsepower more than the hot version. And they're going to be 110 of them, we think. I guess that's a fairly predictable number. And it's going to cost £200,000, we think. What are your thoughts on that? Partly, does the idea appeal? I presume it must have a different, if not different engine, certainly going to have a different gearbox in it, isn't it?
Because
existing gearbox, there's no way that'll take that amount of power or torque. Do you think that there are 110 people out there who will spend... What are we talking about? You know, GT3 RS, McLaren Artura, money on, as you put it to me on the way here, a car that costs £50,000 a cylinder.
Yeah. Seems punchy, doesn't it? I think the idea of the car is fascinating, because I've said all along that the thing about the A110 is that it's inherently right. It's balanced because the engine's in the middle. It's small. It's very light. Mm. It's got double wishbone suspension. It's very simple. It has the basic complexion of a racing car. And so it means that its ultimate potential is enormous. Mm. And they released a bit more of that potential with the S, a bit more again with the R. And it looks like they're going absolutely all out with whatever this one's going to be called. And I think they should be releasing as much of that potential from that basic platform as they should.
Yeah. There's no question about can the chassis handle the power?
No.
It'll be absolutely fine.
No.
I just wonder whether commercially or not.
No, I was coming to that. So if it's limited to 110, and there's no question that there is a hardcore of people out there who love the A110 and love Alpine enough. I mean, in the Alpine community, there are people who will buy anything that Alpine badge is stuck on. It has a following. £200,000 is an awful lot of money. So how many of those are in a position to spend £200,000 on any car? I don't know the answer to that. But I do think there will be a bunch of them who will not view it as too much money. Or they will not be thinking about what else they could have, because they just want the Alpine. So I think Alpine's right to do this. I just don't know if 110 is a realistic number.
Well, I presume the number is partly informed by the business case. It must be entirely informed by the business case. because I'm sure they're not doing it to make a lot. For myself, I'm not sure. Mm. You know, I wish them very well with it. I hope to goodness we get to drive one. Sounds absolutely fascinating. I'm sure there's no reason in the world that, given if it's going to weigh less than a ton and it's going to have those sorts of numbers, I think it will be... I'd be amazed if it wasn't an absolutely exceptional car to drive. I just... I know that people just get... They just get very particular about, you know, particularly about things like the badge on the front of their car. You know, one bloke turns up in their GT3 RS, another one turns up in their hot Alpine. And you've got to explain why you did that. And to you or to me, it's easy, isn't it? You think, well, because it's lighter and it's more pure and it's, you know, it's wonderful, it's rare and it's this, that and the other. But out there where, you know, it's just perception and image, isn't it? And that sort of thing.
It is for most people. It is. But I think there is a nutty hardcore of Alpine enthusiasts.
Oh, I agree.
But are there
110 of them? There 110 of them who are in a position to drop 200 grand.
Well, that's exactly
the question. In a four-cylinder Renault.
Yeah, that's exactly the question.
I really hope there are.
It's impossible.
I'll be pleased if there are.
It's impossible for us to judge how many of those guys there might be out there. I mean, certainly some, but 110 might be a stretch. Let's see. We'll find out, won't we? We really do need to wrap this one up. So let's call it a day there. Thank you, everybody, for watching. If you are on YouTube or for listening, please remember to subscribe or follow wherever you're watching or listening. It really helps us. I know I say it every time, but it really does. And we can see you doing it, and it makes a difference. So please keep doing it. In return, we'll be back next week.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.